Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on child rights and advocacy. This is episode 8. I'm your host, Sammy.
I'm the other host, Josh.
Today we'll be talking with Chelsea, who works at the Office of the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth in Ontario. We'll be talking with Chelsea about a new report released by the office called Search for a New Home. Chelsea, can you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Chelsea Hopper, and I'm the Youth Amplifier on the project Our Voice, Our Turn here at the Advocate's Office. And my project specifically speaks with youth who have been in the child welfare system.
So we're just going to dive into this. Not everyone knows what the Search for Home report is, so can you please briefly explain what the report is and why it was important to do?
Yeah, so the report is called Searching for Home, Residential Review, and basically this report talks about all the issues that have been coming up in residential care settings. These settings include foster care, group care, kinship care, youth mental health, and youth criminal justice systems. And basically this report is trying to get to the bottom of what gaps are currently in the system now and how can we fix them.
And why was it important to do this report? Is it because there was a lot of gaps in the system or?
Yeah, there's gaps in the system. I guess also around the same time that we decided to do the report, the Ministry of Children and Youth Services, they said they were going to do a report of all residential care. And when they did the report, they're focusing not just on youth, but stakeholders and service providers. So that means they're talking to social workers, they're talking to people who work in group homes, that sort of thing. And their scope is very broad. Mm. And because our office, we help youth, we decided that it was really important to do a simultaneous review at the same time they were doing it to give only youth a perspective. Mm-hmm. So we only spoke with youth. And these we spoke with were from as far north as Kenora and as close to home as Toronto. And we spoke to youth in all the residential settings and just tried to get a clear picture of what gaps were in the system.
Okay, so that's great. I think it's really great that the report concentrates on youth voice because that, I think, often missed in the conversation. In the report, I had noticed that there was the term family and how it was defined, and you guys had defined the term family very differently than, I guess, what the general public sees family as. Can you explain what that definition was and why it was important to define it that way?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of a really interesting question because I think what we tried to do was not define it. And that was because what you learn when working with youth is that every youth is individual and they want individual things, they need individual things. And so what you may view as a family might be, you know, a nuclear two-parent home, where someone else, it might be a single mom. And to some youth that we talked to, they even explained that it may not even be biological parents or family relatives, it's people in their community, it can be their teacher. Family really is a very versatile term, and right now the office is also working on another project that's trying to define what family is. And the whole idea around this is that there really is no strict definition because family, it grows, it extends, and it's not always what everyone thinks it really is. So in this report, when we defined family, we tried to make sure that it included everyone, and we basically when we used the term family, it didn't just mean the nuclear family, it meant any type of support systems that were in the youth's life at the time that they thought were important.
Well, I think that's so important because if you think about how services are provided and the fact that you require a family member, usually your parents, to sign off on things or to get access to services, and in many cases, youth are trying to access services because of their parents and they don't want to have their parents' permission. And I've heard of very few services that will just take the youth as they are. Like there was the name escapes me, but I just learned about this an organization that provides mental health services, as it's been deemed, to youth that does not require a parent signature, and they give 10 free counseling sessions, and then the organization will decide after those 10 if further support is needed from that specific organization or if they can refer them to another separate service that again is a service that is just
the youth.
And they don't need the parent. And if you think about it, like, youth will often define family in such unique ways.
Yeah.
And often I would say mainstream society says, no, but your family is this because you were young. And it's and this is like the whole ageism thing we spoke about, or adultism, where youth constantly, even up until the age of 18, have their voice and who they define as family. They have that thrown away because of the number that's on their birth certificate rather than the feelings that they're having,
yeah.
Right? And so Like, I think it's great that the report defined or didn't define family. Is it really what you guys were doing, like you said, that you didn't define family, because that also means, like, for any youth who does read this and sees that family was so loosely defined or that family wasn't defined, it means they can see themselves within this report and say, you know, I can identify with this. Because I think, even for myself, when I read reports that are related to my identity, whether it's youth, blackness, gayness, what have you, whenever it's been defined in a way that excludes me, I can't support it. It's hard for me to support it, at least. Yeah. And so I think that's what's great, is that this definition of family allows so many young people that have that definition or lack of definition, you will have that support behind the document.
Yeah. I like what you said, too, about that youth mental health place allowing youth to kind of have a few free sessions before they further examine. But again, it's all based on the youth, because a lot of what we hear too is like plan of cares. I'm not sure if you guys kind of know what a plan of care is, but when a youth is in the child welfare system, they have a social worker, a caseworker, and then every 6 months they meet with their social worker to kind of see, like, progress, you know, where you're going, what are your goals.
Every 6 months, that addresses.
Because that really works, you know, on a day-to-day basis. But the interesting thing about that is that a lot of youth don't like their plan of cares, because sometimes there's one girl we spoke to where her dad was invited to her plan of care, and her dad was actually the reason she was in care in the first place, and she had all her own goals set up, and then her dad came to the plan of care and he was like, no, these are very bad goals, like, you know, and she, I think she would have preferred to have maybe a friend or a teacher, someone who actually knew her and she could identify with as her family, as opposed to just, you know, calling her biological parents because that's her family, you know, that's what they define as family.
But, like, I wonder if it comes down to, like, policy issues as well, right? And how policy has defined family, too, right? Because in those instances, I'm not too sure, but the plan of care allows, like, family members, right? Yeah. And there's a certain definition of how...
Well, they actually allow anyone supportive in the family. Mm-hmm. But, like, you don't just have to have your parents. They say you're allowed to have anyone. But I think it's almost easiest to say, you know, this is your dad. It's on paper. Yes. We can find him. They didn't really ask her, like... Would you like to have had him here?
Well, and even the policy, like, I'm sorry, let's name who's behind that policy. Mm-hmm. Who's behind these policies? It is usually heterosexual, straight, white people of the nuclear family creating what they deem standards of family.
It is.
And they do so in the policy. So, like, let's not talk about policies as though it's a thing. In fact, there are people behind this thing, and then they create it, and then they get to take a step back. And what happens after that? Their hands are off of it, and this is the kind of the point of the report, because it's to say we know there are people behind this thing, and they need to read this thing as it is, as you know, a system that's biased, right? So, like, if you don't come from that nuclear family, for example, I kind of find it hilarious that the dad, not hilarious, but, like, ironic that the dad is the reason that she's in care. But then they deem him
to be the one with good judgment over her goals and
like,
her life.
And that just goes to show, like, how little voice she had.
Yeah.
Like, did it not occur to them to be like, hi, would you be uncomfortable with your father coming?
Coming to the plan of care,
Who would be the best person for you?
Exactly, right? And I think that's what this report really is really about. It's about, like, all the questions you guys could have or all the questions people should have. It's all about listening to youth voice. Mm-hmm. And I know it's very hard when you're in a bureaucracy to think like on a small scale, like individual level, because all of us, obviously our policies are meant to withstand hundreds of cases, and you know, we can't, it's very hard to create policy that's individualized, but if you look at policy in a way where you listen to the youth and then you kind of construct it, it's a lot.
But why couldn't you, why can't you put in policy, like, so you know what, for example, social workers, it's in our ethics, self-determination is in our ethics, and yes, policies within services can come to conflict, but technically policies within services are supposed to take that into account when they hire social workers and have social workers in that space, our code of ethics. Therefore, if self-determination is in social workers' code of ethics, is supposed to be that social services are supposed to adhere by, why can't broader policy include self-determination in how youth are provided services? Why is it not there? Well, why? Because the people who created these policies think that youth are naive, think that youth are innocent, think that youth don't know what they want or need. And I'd say, like, especially in this generation with, like, technological access, more and more youth are being confronted with the idea of, well, I should have my own voice, and this is ridiculous.
They want
exactly. And so that, I think that's what's coming to head right now, is like, if you look at the political movements, it's, they're all very young again. Like, just mm-hmm, just like it was back in the 1960s with civil rights movement.
It's 15-year-old, 16-year-old, so you're like, when I was in high school, I wasn't thinking that, but how, where are you now?
When I was in high school, I was like, yo, what are you eating for lunch?
I know.
Like, let me tell you about heteronormativity.
Right? Like, 5K followers on Instagram, and I'm like, you're so smart.
Exactly.
It's really good.
But, like, that's what I mean. Like, young people have access to more information, they're constantly being told that they don't know.
Yeah.
And in fact, young people are saying, but
we do.
Know,
yeah.
And so it's time for you to sit back and take a lesson.
Yeah.
But I think it comes down to, like, the training, too, of, like, people writing the policies. And, like, I can't even, and my classmates are going to hear this podcast, so they're not going to like it, but there are some classmates and some people that I go to school with, and I'm just like, you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't get it. And I'm one of the few people in the class that comes from that, like, social justice,
mm-hmm.
youth voice perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to bring that into the classroom, and it's still not, they still don't get it. They just look at it at, sometimes as the funding perspective,
mm-hmm.
or, so I think more of that, like, understanding of youth voice needs
mm-hmm.
to be brought into training, like, for the public service for policy, to kind of, like, combat, like, what you were saying with that there's always that understanding of the nuclear family, and those
mm-hmm.
are the white people writing the policies, right? So there needs to be something to challenge their thinking.
At the office, like, I can't quote Irwin verbatim, but I remember when I first started working here in May, there was an article where Irwin explicitly said, like, they asked him, like, what needs to change about child welfare? And he was like, we need to get out of this, like, 1950s notion of, like, what a nuclear family is. And
mm-hmm.
we need to start talking to these youth and defining and asking them to define what they want and who
mm-hmm.
their family is and who they want to support them and that type of thing. So I know that, and again, everything always seems so bleak when you're in the situations and you know that these youth are speaking to, you're not going to help them right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it won't help them for 10 years. Maybe it'll help their siblings who are just getting into the system. But I do know that some people are at least waking up and, like, hearing Irwin say, like, you know, I realize that although Irwin, you know, is a white male,
mm-hmm.
and he maybe has the nuclear family type image, he knows that it's not the same for everyone, and he's
mm-hmm.
trying to enact policy.
Well, and I think at least with Irwin, he knows he doesn't know everything.
Yeah, and that's
and
the best part
about Irwin. He's willing to take a step back.
Yeah.
Well, you get policymakers that are like, oh, we know everything, and it's just like, you don't.
Yeah.
You read a report that was made by researchers who were white and straight and
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth, who went into these communities and studied them and then had to take those narratives and that data, and then they had to put it into a small report, and you were supposed to gather a strong understanding. No, that's not, like, you take the TRC, for example, that is comprehensive. They did not summarize. They left their
mm-hmm.
entire narrative there for everyone to read. And now it's on policymakers to read all of that. They're not going to get a 10-page document. They're going to get hundreds.
It's not going to be easy, right?
Exactly.
It's going to be like skim through. Okay, I read the foreword, and now I understand the whole.
Yeah, well, and I think actually just realize, like, if you think about it, I think the one thing that's happened with youth and young people is we have not come together as a collective, as youth and young people. And in fact, we've been assumed to be a part of and have been taken into other movements. So, for example, we've been taken into the Black Lives Matter movement. We've been taken into the two-spirited LGBTQ pride movement.
So there's
the disability justice
youth,
movement.
But
exactly.
Not just a youth.
Exactly. And you know, and you think about the youth's involvement in those movements, it could probably be very problematic, you know, tokenizing young people. And I just think it's hard to say because, like, you would say, like, if young people came together, there'd be so many varying experiences. But maybe that's the importance, because if young people did come together as a collective based on age and said, these policies, for example, how come I can't vote until the age of 18?
Yeah.
Right? You're literally saying I'm not a citizen until the age of 18 because our citizenship is very much based around being able to vote. So you're saying I'm a non-citizen. You're saying that, you know, how I want my education set up, I require my parents' permission to sign off on it when I'm young. No, I'm telling you this is what I'm interested in. My parents are telling you that this is what I'm not and I shouldn't be doing, but I'm telling you this is what I want to do with my life. Like, all these policies and practices, like, I've never heard, well, I've heard of a few parents that are like, oh, like, I just want them to do what they
do
and be happy and actually mean it. I've heard very few parents actually say that, and their actions speak to that.
Yeah.
And I just think if young people could come together as a collective and could just sit down and, like, write out what's happening, you know, of course, those would be, like, the experiences would vary based on social location of, you know, sexuality, gender identity, sexual orientation, race, ability, or, you know, disability. You know, but those, I think that's important because then it's a learning process for young people as well to really unpack their privilege earlier.
Yeah,
because if they have those conversations younger within a youth collective,
it almost is a struggle now when they're, you know, at a certain age, and they're like, "Why I didn't know any of these things, or why am I having, you know, why am I doing this now?"
Well, and I think I read the report. I think one thing that young people in care, even outside of care, is we experience this extreme isolation because we are clearly told that we don't have choice by our parents. Realistically. I think we feel our experiences are individual, and we don't realize that this is something happening to all young people, where we are pushed and guided, using that term loosely, we're pushed and guided without realizing that maybe that's not something we wanted.
Yeah.
And I think it's like once you go off to college and university, or once you leave the home, the nest, is when you realize, you're like, oh my gosh, like, that was not me where I was back there. Like, this is me. Like, this is an experience I've had, especially being adopted into a transracial adoption, so into a white family. You know, I would describe my familial position right now as pretty much an adult adoption breakdown. Mm-hmm. Because when I was there in the nest, I didn't see the racism, the homophobia, the problems in the town, the lack of support within the home. And now that I'm out of it,
in your environment, you can see everything.
Exactly, and when I'm with other racialized individuals, when I'm with other youth in care, or former youth in care, and I talk to them, I'm just like, my life was a problem.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember being younger and trying to address that, and you know, my voice being reduced because of my age, because I'm young, and I think I know everything. But the assumption then is that, so you're an adult and you know everything?
Yeah. Well, also, the office works like there's, you need to, we have, we work within the UN Convention of Rights of a Child, and that's the idea that it's not the best interest of the child, we just listen to the child. And I think a lot of service providers come from the idea that, like, you know, we know what's best for you, and you can tell us everything you want, but we're working in the, you know, in the best interest of the child. And at the office, we do it very differently, is then we listen to the child and we say, what do you want? And it's kind of, I'm not explaining it very well, but the difference is instead of assuming what the child wants, we're asking what they want. And maybe a youth in care will say, you know, like, I want to go home. And we can't send them home because it's not the best option.
Yeah.
But at least we know what they want.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not...
Well, I would trouble that, though, because, like, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, I would say, has almost been the most problematic pieces of documents that have held young people in the position they are now. Because we're intrinsically saying you have a right based on being a child. You do not have citizenship rights.
Okay.
So you know what I mean? So we're not saying that you are a citizen and therefore you have rights. We are saying you're a child, therefore you are afforded these rights. Which is very problematic because it's still placing young people and children outside of full citizenship. And we're cutting a small space for children and young people. And even then, I'm very sure children and young people weren't involved and spoken to when these rights were made. And I'm very sure that if there were children that were talked to in order to come up with these rights, that they were children of specific social locations with specific abilities to articulate what they want, right? And that's why I trouble, like, of course, the intention behind the document, of course, is important. I just think that my first question is, why the heck did we need this document in the first place to think about children? Like, the fact that we needed this document to think about children shows how much we actually make young people and children invisible.
Yeah.
And their rights as people, not as children, as people invisible. And that document has essentially been a way for governments to be like, no, like, we've addressed young people. And they're not. Like, we're having the same issue.
I feel like my issues with my grounding has always been in the UNCRC. That's been the start of my advocacy career. But my issues with that and with human rights in general is that it's a very, it's westernized. There is, that's where human rights, like, look where the UN's located.
Right.
Right? In New York, right? Like, I mean, it's very westernized. So, like, I struggle with it sometimes that what does human rights look like for someone who's living in another part of the world? Mm-hmm. What does the best interest look like for someone who's living in a part of the world? And that's where I kind of respect where the office takes the position of, like, listening to the individual, because that lived experience is unique. But in general, I mean, that's my issues with the UN seriously. It's very westernized. It's very, Eurocentric. There's no... oh, lost my word.
Well, and even there's no accountability to the UN. And you know what? One thing that I, and in my indigenous approach as a class, social work, you know, it's strongly been said by the indigenous community that they are sick and tired of listening and being researched. And they're sick and tired of people being like, oh, like, we need to start listening. No. We're actually past that point. We need to start acting. And the government needs to start acting. Services need to start acting in ways that are not oppressive towards age. Right? Because that is what's happening, is everyone, they take young people and they put them in focus groups. And then once that's done, they let the young people go. And what happens is young people are, they get this feeling of hope, and then it just it gets taken away. And unfortunately, sometimes that leads to young people losing hope and then taking their own lives. And that, you know, that has happened.
Well, that's kind of one of the big issues with them. Like, when I did this report, like, it was our first report, and I was really excited to do it, and I didn't think it would have such an emotional toll on me, being that, being from care, you know, I kind of packaged the whole care thing, like, I don't think about this for a couple of years, I never thought I'd be doing anything in social work or with, you know, anything to do with child welfare, because it was such a thing I never wanted to touch ever again. I was like, I got out, I'm done, and then I went to all these meetings, and it was heartbreaking, because you go there, and these youth are even telling us, like, the last report we did, the My Real Life book, I think you talked to Sheldon about that, that we were told when we did that report, like, there should be no more reports. Everything we have told you is in this report. We don't want to talk to you anymore. Like, you keep coming to us, great, $40, but then we're going to go home and we're going to, you stir up all these emotions. And, you know, again, like,
there's no healing. There's no, well, no. And you know, and this is what's great about the course I'm taking, is they speak about this idea of research does not end the moment you've package the paper. You need to still be a part of this relationship with the community you just opened wounds to, very traumatic wounds. And, you know, I've seen researchers cry when they hear these things, but it's just like, and, you know, there is such a thing as secondary trauma, but you get to cry and absolve yourself because you wrote this report, but you just opened the wounds to my life, and there's no, and you haven't closed them, and I spent years compartmentalizing that and closing those wounds, and so you've reopened them, and now you have a responsibility to close them again, and that is not going to happen within the 3-hour focus group session that you just created.
Or even when the report comes out.
It's not going to happen with the report, and it sure as heck isn't going to happen when I don't see anything after that report.
Exactly.
When 2 years later, I'm sitting in the same position, if not worse.
Or you know what your friends are. That was a big issue, because, and that's, I think, also where the idea of tokenism comes in with their office, which you really, it's so painful, and, like, it's because, like, we go out and we do this, and we don't close the wounds, and these kids come to these, and, you know, they look great on paper, and great, we did all the, and even in my own position, you know, I'm going out, and I'm like, I've done this, and we can do this, but in the end, we kind of just look like, we look kind of false, because we're just sitting here, and we're just saying, it's okay, don't worry about it, but then change doesn't happen.
Well, and I think that's the thing, like, young people have their voice, like, taken as, I'm sorry, like, we're being used as tools. Like, we all, everyone knows young people know how to jerk the heartstrings of the taxpayers, right? And it's very unfortunate that, like, instead, like, for example, like, why is it that it needs to be in a report? I've never understood that. Why not put young people and the policymakers in the same room and have a conversation? Why don't we clarify that as research? Because then this person, this policymaker, is going to be hearing my full narrative. They're not going to get the tidbits that you picked up as the researcher, right? And this is what's happening to young people, where the most dramatic parts of their story sometimes get put in a report, and they're just like, you read the report and you're just like, I didn't think you were going to put that in there. Like, Or the stuff that you thought was important doesn't get put in there, and you're just like,
and that's really hard when writing a report, because there are so many, like, amazing stories, and obviously, when we want to push legislation, we need to use the most, like, I don't want to say the most dramatic or the most.
Well, no,
I mean, like, it sucks that in order to get heard, we need to make people cry.
It's like forcing a policy window. Yeah,
yeah,
and like
it's hard.
But that just goes to show like how screwed up it is. Like
it is.
That we don't listen to young people just based on the fact that they're saying we've had these experiences. No, these young people literally have to like delve inside of themselves, rip open the most painful wounds, and hope that they can close them again, and hope that you're going to use that those stories, that part of their narrative, and you're going to use those for change that will help them heal. And I think what's happening, I'm not saying speaking to this office specifically, but what a lot of places with young people is that's happening, and there's very little change. Like, young people, I'd say, still lack a lot of access. Young people are more now than ever are lacking economic access. Young people now more than ever are lacking access to this city. We're getting pushed out. And when people are like, well, it's a young city, it's a young white city.
Or also, like, you just need too much experience, so students aren't coming because, you know, I think I read an article that was like, it's a great employment city, but not for students or not for young people, because they want you to have 6 years of experience.
Exactly.
And, you know, you're young, you're not going to get that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's been such a focus, though, on, I think you were touching on it before, someone was saying that, like, why not just act? I think it was you, Josh.
Yeah.
But there's been such a focus on the last few years of listening to the voices, writing the reports, getting, you know, empirical evidence and all that stuff. And no action has ever, like, come out of that. There's always just been that focus of just, it's just listen, and that's all that everyone has ever concentrated on.
Yeah.
And I think the next step now is to start acting, right? Like, we have the empirical stuff.
Yeah.
And
you know what? This empirical stuff, like, not to
diminish it at all.
Diminish the report. Yeah. This evidence has been here for years. I was reading stuff by Kim Snow. And she's done a bunch of research on the experience of care. I've written essays on the experience of care that are quite recent. You know, it's just, and that's why I'm frustrated, because if policymakers couldn't listen to the statistic and now they have to listen to the horror story, what does that show how they value young people? That's all I have to say, because I know that there are certain types of people who could throw at a statistic and have that attached to their identity, and they would have their needs served. And that's what bothers me, because, you know, young people say they don't want to become a part of a statistic, but what's happening right now is, it'd almost be nice to just be a part of a statistic and then just accept that, rather than me
having
to go
tell your whole story
my
just
whole
to
story.
Get something
exactly.
done.
Right? And this is like, you know, attaching this to care. Like, they know that, you know, you shouldn't be placing, really shouldn't do transracial foster homes.
Yeah.
This is so inappropriate, and my experience has spoken to that, and I've heard many experiences that speak to that. The training of foster parents. What is going on there? Because I'm questioning if there is any, the amount of violence, whether that is physical, sexual, emotional, spiritual, speaking to Indigenous peoples and, you know, Caribbean peoples that came to Canada. You know, the amount of problems that are here and have been known for years.
Yeah.
It just goes, you know, I don't like this term, but like, you can't fix the master's house with the master's tools. And that's kind of what we're doing.
We're just trying to relocate things and do the same thing without branching out.
And you know what? And you know, let's not just use the master's tools. Let's get rid of the master's house.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's time for young people to say, this is how we want our services to look like. And it's time for governmental services to think about, okay, what's the long term? What is this going to look like long term? Oh, this is going to be beneficial long term. This is going to save us money long term. We're not going to have youth going to jail. We're not going to have youth experiencing homelessness.
But in all honesty, I think, and I'm going to get slapped for this, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think society has built up youth and children as that adults know better than.
But that's
and
what I'm saying is, like,
it's not going to change.
But I'd say
though.
Young people are the only. I'd say we are marginalized because we are not afforded voting rights. We young people are, I'd say, one of the only marginalized groups that have not come together as young people and said these are the problems as young people that we experience.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why we, like, young people haven't, though, is because it's the way society has kind of individualized us. I don't think youth collectively may think, okay, we don't have a voice, we got to make a change, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we're going to actually create a movement now, because there's that, we're told that we don't have a voice. I don't know if I'm like.
But I would, the only reason why I argue against that is because we've already been assumed to be a part of these other movements of Black Lives Matter, LGBT, and
So we're picking our movements.
Yeah, so we're picking movements that are related to other identities other than age, because there's smoke over our eyes, and you know, even in this room, I swear, like, if we were to sit in a room full of young people and explain these as issues, I feel like a lot of young people would be like, oh yeah, like, that is problematic. Like, why was someone deciding my future for me when I knew my future was this? You know, in this case, why was someone who was the reason why I am in care, why was this person in the same room as me deemed as my support by you? Like, this is just so problematic. And I just feel that young people, it's not that we haven't taken the initiative. I'd say there's smoke over our eyes, and we need to blow that out of there, and then we can come together, because you know what? Years ago, people would have said slavery wasn't going to end.
Yeah.
You know what? Years ago, people would have said that gay marriage isn't going to come around. You know, a decade ago, trans people would have said we would not be visible. You know, 5 years ago, Indigenous people would say we would not be recognized. And that, I mean, there's still a lot of problems with the colonialism within Canada. But this is what I'm saying. So young people can do it. Someone has to step up and say, it's time for young people to have our own voice, to decide what services we get, how these services look, and who provides these services. Because, you know, I am getting sick and tired of hearing, you know, for example, racialized youth going into care and experiencing racism. Like, this is ridiculous. Yeah. Like, how was that not figured out?
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I lost my train of thought. But I think we should wrap it up anyways, because we're over time.
Do you have any last questions for me?
Do you have any last thoughts? Because this interview is about you.
Any last thoughts? I mean, it's a report, and I'm sick of writing reports. Not this my first one, but I'm sick of having to write reports. And youth are sick of, I think, having to come to our meetings to hear reports. And this report, I think, is very important only because we were able to shed light on some areas, like youth criminal justice system, where I didn't know anything about youth
facilities. Yeah, I didn't even know that would be part of residential care.
Yeah, I didn't, like, I kind of got it, but I didn't really know, and so I was able to talk to some of those youth. But I hope this, I hope the recommendations are taken seriously. And some of the recommendations do address issues Ruth brought up. Like, one of them is more training for service providers and foster parents. Because, like you said, like, we're getting a lot of burnout of foster parents. And you're wondering why kids are getting put in really shitty homes. Sorry, crappy homes. But it's because we're having maybe really good ones burnt out. Mm-hmm. Because maybe people don't know what they're getting into in the first place. And then there's no support. Like, there's not a support system for foster parents.
Yeah.
So they're burnt out. Maybe, you know, their kid who just went through a traumatic experience, maybe they punch a wall because they're really upset. Yeah. They're sending them right back to the other foster home. And it's becoming a crazy cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So that recommendation, I hope, is taken seriously. As well as we really want to try to push for better salaries for CYWs and people like that, because youth were telling us, even in group homes, that they think their service providers are coming from like youth justice programs. So they just want to go into jails eventually. Mm-hmm. So we're having these people who are working with the youth, that's not even really their focus.
Yeah, they're using it as a stepping stone. Right? They're using it for the 6-year experience. Yeah.
Exactly. And then we have CYWs who aren't even getting paid enough, and you're wondering why they're getting burnt out, or maybe they're in a group home and they see a policy that they don't agree with, but they're so afraid of losing their job because they have OSAP debt and whatever.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? So that's another one of our recommendations that we really hope they take seriously, because if we're paying people better, maybe they will care, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe there'll be people going into programs that youth actually want to see them in. I hope the support, if anything, people just, they see that there are gaps, and maybe, you know, doesn't do anything but wake them up and say, you know, my real life book, things haven't changed. Maybe you think they've changed, but they haven't. So I guess I hope that people who are supposed to read it, they can see, like, the value in the report, and that the youth, our hope is always the youth see themselves in the report. And, you know, we had a really short timeline to write this, and so I hope that anyone we interviewed, they feel like they're in there, they didn't get left out, or we didn't pick, you know, the best parts for us and not the parts that they want us to hear. But that's just, I guess, my overall hope for the report.
Well, I think that's a good way to end. Do you have any last words, Josh?
Well, I was just going to say, like, you know, while we were speaking on the idea of tokenizing young people and everything, like I said, I think the one good thing that this report did in the way it defined family is it did include a lot of young people who have their voice excluded because of not having that nuclear family. Mm. And, you know, and I find it ironic now seeing that, like, foster care and youth criminal justice system is in the same report, because it's like you can almost see a funnel between the two of the experience of foster care and
or youth criminal justice. Or they go from foster care to youth criminal justice so easily.
And so, you know, and I hope the folks that read this report see that, because it's very problematic that homes are training criminals. It's not training, but are having
producing folks, them essentially.
Having folks choose criminality. So, and I hope that people see that. And like you said, take the recommendations and not just listen, but act on those recommendations.
Well, I think that's a good way for us to end this lovely episode and conversation. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you, Chelsea, for taking the time out to speak with me and Josh. If you're a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have any ideas of what topics we should be talking about, please email me or Josh at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.